friends into the back seat, the daters often felt pressure to talk, and not just about their favorite movies or pizza joints. When you add cameras into the mix and crew who are expecting something, people feel like they need to perform, Renfro said. And that forced people to talk about real things. You have to have more honest conversation about things of substance because you can't be lazy. There also weren't any lavish, fantastical locations to distract from the one-on-one interaction. Early in the day, there'd usually be an activity. Going to the beach, playing basketball, hitting up a comedy club, and then they'd head out to eat. Most of the dates took place at average-looking chain restaurants where the most important feature was the bar. And yes, more often than not, the contestants would get drunk. Tequila shots at a Mexican restaurant, Coronas by the boardwalk, wine at an Italian place. That's when a taxi would come into play, chauffeuring the pair around for the rest of the evening. We didn't have the bachelor budget, said Renfro. And they are selling romance. I think what we provided was reality. We had very relatable dates. I don't know if everyone can relate to being swept away in a private plane to Paris for dinner. One especially popular blind date destination was Splash, a now-defunct Los Angeles spa equipped with a plethora of super sanitary private hot tub rooms. Producers loved this venue. For one, the show was allowed to film there for free, and it allowed for contestants to show some skin before they almost always started hooking up. Splash became so popular that in a later season, during a week of episodes featuring millionaire daters, the owner of the spa was sent on a date of his own. So many people knew about the place from all the exposure that he'd made so much money, Renfro said. So many dates turned out to be total disasters, often in those very hot tubs, that Blind Date ended up serving as a cautionary tale for many viewers. Renfro said he'd often hear from married couples who told him the show had saved their relationships. After watching, some audience members shared, "We'd say to ourselves, whatever problems we have, we can work them out. We just don't want to have to do that again." No longer was it considered racy to make out on TV or bare your soul to millions of strangers. By the late 90s, nearly every teen had an AOL account, and some were even starting to find love in online chat rooms. We were beginning to market ourselves, making websites, blogging on LiveJournal, realizing that the internet and television had the power to make us stand out from the crowd. Young people now dreamed of being on television, and MTV was there to make that fantasy attainable. Brian Graydon, the network's president of production around the millennium, had doubled down on dating shows. Teens would rush home to watch kids like themselves dating with the aid of their parents, Date My Mom, Lie Detectors, Exposed, and Ultraviolet Wands, Room Raiders. One of MTV's most popular dating shows during this period was Next, in which a group of singles tried to find love on a bus. Because who among us hasn't dreamed of falling for someone while seated at a table that converts into a bed? Five guys, for example, would be secluded on an RV, known as the Next Bus, that would roll around to different locations. At each stop, one young man would get off the bus and start a date with a woman at the helm. If at any point she didn't feel like she was connecting with a guy, she could yell, "Next!" and he would have to retreat to the bus. At the next stop, she'd meet her next option. Like on The Bachelor, the bus added a helpful, bubble-esque intensity to Next. Contestants had no cell phones, and the windows on the vehicle had been blacked out. All the focus had to remain on the people inside the bus. Sometimes, on episodes with LGBTQ participants, matches started to form before the contestants even met the person they were meant to be fighting for. "It was always a party on the bus," said Miller, who was an EP on Next. "Sometimes the dates would be really stiff, and we'd get on the walkies like, 'How's the bus going?' And they'd be like, 'Oh, it's a party in here! This one guy just bet another guy to shave his eyebrow off!'" "My favorite shows to produce reveal natural, interesting dynamics between men and women," continued Miller, who, after working on six MTV dating shows, is often called the queen of dating in the industry. "I see myself as a social anthropologist, and dating is the ultimate way to see how people connect." "Sure," she admits. Next may not have led to any great psychological discoveries about the mating habits of young adults, but she still thinks dating shows serve an important purpose. You know when you get together with your girlfriend and you almost want her to have gone on a bad date because the story is infinitely more interesting? Miller asked. "We all know as women that you have to kiss 9 frogs to get 1 prince. So why not enjoy the process? I meet so many women that are like, 'Ugh, I hate dating.' And I'm always sad for women when I hear that they just want the end product. I think they're missing out on a lot. I never want women to feel like they're failing when they have a bad date. Most dates and relationships end. That's just the way it is. But somehow, that's not how it's taught to us, and I feel sad about that. It's not embarrassing if you go out on a bad date. No, ladies, it's fantastic. Let's do brunch, and I want to hear every detail. Why I'm a fan. Nikki Glaser. I honestly probably got my ideas of romance from Ross and Rachel. A guy needs to pine over a girl for years, and then the forces that be finally bring them together. But it's a long struggle of not being able to say how you feel, and it's all very spontaneous and in the moment. When Friends went away, there was no other romance I really cared about, so I was like, we'll check The Bachelor out. You see someone legitimately fall in love, whether it's lust or love or just, you know, getting caught in the moment. I relate to the show a lot. Like, just falling head over heels in a very unsafe way. This is not going to end well, but it's fun to watch. Because of the nature of the competition on the show, you have to be emotive. It's so interesting to me because a lot of the times the bachelorettes want to hear from the guys, I love you and I'm ready for marriage. In regular life, it would be a terrible decision to reveal that stuff, to say, I'm all in, I love you, I want to get married. That's an insane thing to do. In real life, my advice to men would be to play it cool even if you do feel those things. Even though on paper I want to hear those things, hearing it would scare me away. I would want the guy who doesn't seem into me. I'm not proud that I watch The Bachelor. I don't think it's a feminist show, but I do think feminists are into it because it's an interesting case study. I don't have guilt about it because I just like what I like and I'm secure in that. I think we are seeking out these shows that remind us of the 90s and early 2000s when Britney Spears was the woman to be. It's kind of like a throwback because it is so vapid and so stuck in the early 2000s. I've watched The Kardashians, and when I watched that show, I wasn't one to be like, I just watch it to make fun of them. It's truly entertaining to me. You shouldn't be ashamed to enjoy reality television because it's like reading nonfiction. You're just watching people. It's real. I know that there are setup situations, and I suspend disbelief to be able to watch it, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting to watch people be put in a situation that you would never find yourself in. It's really not a feminist show because the goal is to get married, and I'm just so annoyed by that. Why does everything have to be about getting a ring at the end of this? Why can't they just progress enough to be like, this is the person you choose to be with in a committed relationship? It's a sad ending, these two people who barely know each other saying they'll get married. We don't care that much. Just tell us they're going to be together and work on a relationship. That's way more interesting than locking these two into eternity forever. It's all about kids. I think people get married because they want kids. You know virgins who want to have sex but can't until they get married, so they just get married to get this other thing out of the way? It's like that. We need to change the conversation. Okay, so if she wants a family, she still has a family without marrying someone. We don't want to see them getting married. We just want to see them getting proposed to because the idea of someone wanting to spend the rest of their life with you is better than actually doing it. Chapter 4. The Road to the Mansion. If you are over the age of 21, you are eligible to apply to be a contestant on The Bachelor. If you are over the age of 21 and have been banned from attending official Bachelor events by ABC Brass, you are still eligible to apply to be a contestant on The Bachelor. Not that you'll have a shot in hell of making it on The Bachelor, but you can still apply! This was my logic as I scrolled through the casting website the show always advertises during its commercial breaks. Let's just look at what the application would require. No need to actually press submit, right? As it turns out, if you want to apply to be on The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, the online application is your best bet. It doesn't involve much critical thinking, only a few vital biographical details. Height, weight, do you have any children, occupation, what is the nearest big city to you and how far is it? Have you ever applied to be on the show before? What's your Instagram handle? How about Facebook? Can you send us the hottest picture of yourself in minimal clothing? And finally, why do you want to be on the show? Aha! A deceptively simple question, akin to those horrifically broad, tell us about yourself, or why do you want to go here, prompts you encounter on college applications. But it was so hard to separate myself from the reality of the situation. You know, the ban, my lack of a bikini body, an overwhelming fear of helicopters / bungee jumping / mean girls, that I found it difficult to pursue the question seriously, even as a thought exercise. Come on, Amy. Just imagine you look like Margot Robbie. Think about all the fun travel you'll get to do, the potential sex you'll have in a body of water, the Neil Lane ring you'll get to wear for less than a year, the thousands of dollars you'll make from Instagram sponsorships, the lifestyle blog you'll launch, the free plastic surgery you'll get, the subsequent tabloid photo spread. So many gems await you. I had nada. So I decided to check out the mail-in application. Perhaps it would necessitate even less effort on my part. To my horror, this bad boy was loaded with far more probing questions than the online application. This was serious, the kind of thing I imagine the cast and crew taking a much harder look at than the online application, which, let's be real, is probably all about the photograph. If I was going to take this seriously, the mail-in application was the obvious choice. I readjusted my attitude, put on some Brad Paisley, that's what people on The Bachelor listen to, right? And got to typing. Nickname, age, job, hometown, siblings, yada, yada, yada. No, I've never been arrested or had a restraining order issued against me, but aren't you gonna background check this shit anyway? I did audition to be on a reality show once, but it was about aspiring journalists who got to work at Rolling Stone, so I feel like that doesn't even count. I've never been engaged, I don't have kids, I don't drink, and I will not start on this show. Okay, now we're getting real. Are you genuinely looking to get married and why? Yes, because I'm 32 and society / your show / my parents make me feel ashamed of being single at this age. Also because I like spooning, watching Netflix, and splitting bills. Why would you want to find your spouse on our TV show? Truly, how can one answer this honestly without acknowledging one is somewhat of a fame whore? I want a shot with a cute, highly sought-after dude, and if I win, my confidence will skyrocket? I want to go on lavish, over-the-top fantasy dates instead of meeting a guy from OkCupid at a taco truck because Jonathan Gold gave it a good review. I want to be engaged, but I would also like to make $5,000 by posting a photo with teeth whitener on Instagram. Please describe your ideal mate in terms of physical attraction and in terms of personality attraction. Bearded, hairy, not Jake Pavelka. How many serious relationships have you been in and how long were they? What happened to end those relationships? Ugh, do we really have to go down this road? Fine. Let's say 3 serious relationships. About 2 years a pop. I eventually realized I don't want to marry you. Bye. What are your hobbies and interests? I am interested in my dog, Riggins, and hanging out with him. Do you have any pets? See above. Okay, let's zoom through the rest of these. Special talents. I'm good at getting people to tell me their secrets and picking out the perfect gift. Languages? I can speak very poor French that magically gets better when it is being spoken to an attractive Frenchman. And no, I do not have any tattoos. 3 surprising adjectives about me. Compassionate. I'm not as mean as I seem. Kooky. I'm pretty weird. Naturey. My mom suggested this. It just means I like lying in fields and looking at the moon and stuff. Proudest accomplishment. Maybe moving across the country and setting up a life for myself in LA? Is that lame? Ugh, whatevs. I don't care. I'm not getting on the show anyway. Ooh, yay. Final question. What have you not found but would like to have in a relationship? I guess I've yet to find the appropriate power balance. You know that old wife's tale women often hear? Marry someone who loves you a little bit more than you love them. I've been with guys who I felt were more into me than I was into them, and it's always been a turnoff. Of course, I've been in the opposite position too, and that sure as hell doesn't feel good. But being with the man who I love and who loves me just slightly more than I love him, I've never had that. Frankly, I kind of think that whole wife's tale is bullshit because power dynamics ebb and flow. And if I was on The Bachelor, this guy would have all the power in the relationship anyway, so this is probably going to work out great. Now all I have to do is submit anywhere from 5 to 15 pictures of myself, making sure to include good close-up shots and full body pics. I feel like everyone must go with 15 photos, right? Well, I'm going with 0 since I won't even put a full body pic on Bumble. Oh, and apparently I should make a video if I want to ensure I'm seen by the casting team and show off my sparkling personality. The instructions say I should offer up lots of energy and big smiles. I need to find a well-lit room and make sure I don't stand in front of a window. Instead, I need to find a colorful background that won't make me look washed out. I shouldn't wear black, white, intense prints, hats, or sunglasses. I should wear an outfit I'd put on if I were going to a nice restaurant for dinner. As far as the content of the video goes, in between my big smiles, I'm supposed to show off my apartment and my pet. I should talk about my love story, my ultimate fantasy date, and my favorite actor, Ryan Gosling, whose face is on the tea towels hanging from my oven. I should showcase my freezer filled with Trader Joe's macaroni and cheese because you want to know what's for dinner. I should highlight my couch because the casting team wants to see my workout routine. I should end the video by giving both a close-up and a full body shot of myself. This is very important. Guys, can you imagine actually doing all of that? Sure. Even the most jaded among us have probably fantasized about what it would be like to be on a reality show, but going through all the effort to actually get on one? That's a level of commitment that, frankly, I found difficult to comprehend. I mean, I couldn't even get through this damn application, let alone gin up a fun and flirty video and then subject myself to months of in-person interviews. But let's say, miraculously, I'd sent in the application and video, and the producers were so charmed by me that after a few phone calls, they decided they wanted to meet me in person. And since we're already going out on a limb here, let's say I don't live in LA. I'm from Boston. What would have happened next? Well, I'd be invited to come to LA for one of two final audition weekends, all expenses paid, to meet the production team in person. After I agreed to the trip, the show would book my travel, and a couple of weeks later, I'd head to the airport. When I was on the plane, I'd get a text message from my handler instructing me to text them when I landed. On the runway at Los Angeles International Airport, I'd send the text and hop on a shuttle to the nearby Sheraton Gateway, where the auditions were taking place. Once at the airport hotel, I'd call my handler, who would immediately meet me and rush me to a check-in room in a more discreet part of the building. There, I'd be given a 150-question personality test to bring back to my room and complete there. The test would be filled with multiple choice and true or false questions. Do you have out-of-body experiences? Do you think you can control things with your mind? Have you ever wanted to kill someone? Some of these questions would be asked several times, worded differently. After I handed in the test, I would be told not to leave my room. If by some chance a guest spotted me and asked what was going on, I would be told to say I was part of a movie production. I would be given a $50 daily stipend. If I wanted alcohol, I would be instructed to call a specific number, and drinks would be sent to me. I would not interact with any other potential contestants. This would be the first day of the finals weekend. The next day, a Saturday, I would wake up around 8 a.m. and be picked up by my handler. The handler would proceed to take me to a handful of different stations. First, I'd have a few pictures of myself taken. Then I'd be escorted to a room to have a one-on-one interview with a producer. If I later made it onto the show, I'd come to realize that this room resembled an ITM setup, the kind of space in which contestants give in-the-moment interviews, talking about their feelings and experiences. There would likely be candles and mood lighting behind me. After 20 minutes of speaking with the producer privately, I would be asked, "Hey, do you want to meet some of my friends?" I would be walked to an adjoining room, where I would be greeted by roughly 24 producers sitting stadium style. I would quickly become aware that they had watched my entire private ITM as it was unfolding on a television screen. The producers would have me sit down and would start asking me questions rapid fire. Had I watched the last season of The Bachelorette? Did any of the guys stand out to me? What was I looking for in a man? What was my dream job? If I could have that dream job, if I cut off one of my limbs, would I do it? Would I rather have a triple D bra cup or write a cover story for Vogue? Just as the questions started to become more outlandish, the producers would wrap up the session and a handler would take me to meet with the show's therapist. From 2002 through summer 2017, that was psychologist Dr. Catherine Selden. According to the California Board of Psychology, Selden is a state-licensed psychologist who graduated from Pepperdine University and has no disciplinary actions against her license. She was always made available to contestants throughout the season. She was not a presence on set, but emerged anytime she was requested. And cast members were supposed to meet with her after they were eliminated. "I actually really like Dr. Selden," said Charlene Joint, an opera singer who wrestled with leaving Bachelor Juan Pablo Galaviz's season, but ultimately did so of her own accord. "I felt like she got me. She told me I was one of the most self-analytical or introspective female contestants they'd ever had on the show. After I exited, they took me to a hotel suite, and the doctor was there waiting for me with a room service menu at like 3 a.m. She's on call 24/7. I had never spoken to a shrink before, but I loved her." But contestants were first acquainted with Dr. Selden during the casting process. So she would be in possession of the personality test I'd filled out and would spend roughly an hour asking me questions about it. At times, she would get personal. Had I ever cheated on anyone? Did I have a history of mental illness or depression? Did I ever drink too much? Did I ever get into fights when I was drunk? Next, my handler would bring me to a private investigator. This person would be trained to dig up any skeletons in my closet, partly to use for my storyline, but also to get ahead of any tabloid stories that could come to the surface if I was on the show. Had I ever been arrested? Had I ever sent nude photos to anyone? Had I ever made a sex tape? Had I gotten a DUI? Finally, I would be taken for a medical examination. Samples of my blood and urine would be collected. These samples would be tested for drugs and sexually transmitted diseases. I would fill out my medical history and answer questions about my health. If I were on any medication, I would tell the medical professional, who would want to know whether I would need my pills during production. Then I would be escorted back to my room and given something called the fun packet. The questions inside would be light. What's your favorite movie? Who do you look up to? If you could have dinner with anyone dead or alive, who would it be? What's your ideal date? The answers I gave to the questions in the packet would be used in my bio on ABC.com if I made it on the show. After I was done with the fun packet, a handler would check on me and walk me out of the hotel. I would be allowed to go out in LA as long as I texted the handler when I returned to the Sheraton. The following morning, a Sunday, I would fly back to Boston and wait to hear if I'd made it past the pool of 50 finalists and on to The Bachelor. In the following weeks, producers would discuss my performance and analyze the materials I'd submitted to determine whether I should be cast. If it turned out I had an STD, I'd be taken out of the running immediately. And apparently, that's the top reason applicants don't make it onto the show. "I learned a lot about life from those tests," said Ben Hatta, Fleiss's old assistant who was privy to the casting process. "As soon as the medical test came back, you'd see that herpes was the biggest thing. And sometimes, you'd be the first person to tell a contestant that they had herpes. You'd be like, you should call your doctor." "Why?" We're not gonna be able to have you on our show, but you should call your doctor." Then they'd realize that they'd been denied from The Bachelor, and now a bunch of people knew they had herpes. As for the psychological testing, Fleiss likes to say that The Batch has some of the most thorough background checks in the business, a lesson he learned after that whole Rick Rockwell fiasco. "We're really careful about who we let on the show," he said at the Banff World Media Festival in 2012. "We lose a lot of great potential characters because we're so tough and stringent. Anyone who has any sort of borderline personality disorder or instability or any sort of past involving contemplation of suicide, we just can't take the risk. We just don't." But according to numerous producers who've worked on The Bachelor, the rules aren't always that strict. There's psychological tests they have to pass, but there's a window of the past. Do you know what I mean? Insinuated Michael Carroll, the producer who got so close to contestants that he even crashed in their rooms occasionally. "You'd know there'd be a possibility of someone being kind of unhinged, like she passed, but just barely. You can see it at the casting events during the interviews. Oh, this chick is gonna go fucking nuts. She's amazing." I asked him to describe the kind of behavior he was talking about. Say, for example, Carol told a woman to describe her first love. You don't want the girl who says her first boyfriend played lacrosse and went to Harvard. You want the girl who dated a guy who rode a motorcycle and was the bane of her parents' existence. You want the girl who's like, "Oh, he was super cool and we would go fuck in his parents' pool," Carol explained. You get the feeling of who pops on TV and who's coming unhinged and who's gonna go for it. Rosalind Papa, an infamous Bachelor villain, recalled her session with Dr. Selden being particularly troubling. The psychologist asked Papa if she'd ever struggled with mental illness, and the single mother was candid about her battle with depression. Even though she wasn't feeling low at the time, she was honest about the fact that depression was an ongoing issue in her life. If they were really trying to protect you, you'd think that would be sort of a red flag, and they would say, well, maybe this is someone who can't handle this kind of pressure, said Papa, who ended up getting kicked off of Jake Pavelka's season in 2010. Much more on that later. But instead, it was almost like, okay, perfect. You're perfect for the show. You're going to cry. You're going to say some really screwed up stuff. Looking at it, I can see why I should not have been a candidate. Frankly, I think you have to be slightly insane to agree to the contract the show makes contestants sign. I've looked at contracts from a few different seasons of the show. The one I'm quoting from here is from 2015, and they barely change from year to year, save for some updates about social media policies. So let's take a walk through this ironclad 27-page document, shall we? Okay, first off, and this probably seems obvious, you must agree to be filmed up to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But this may also be by means of hidden cameras and microphones, according to the contract, meaning you're likely going to be caught at some point in a less than positive light. You should have no expectation of privacy. Furthermore, because this is a reality show, you must acknowledge that elements of surprise will be included. You must be prepared for anything, including twists and surprises. Producers or others connected to the show, the contract reads, may intentionally or unintentionally make misrepresentations or omissions concerning the series. Basically, the producers can mislead you, and that's totally kosher. Here's where we get to an especially important clause, because it's in all caps. I understand, acknowledge, and agree that producer may use or reveal personal information which may be embarrassing, unfavorable, shocking, humiliating, disparaging, and or derogatory, may subject me to public ridicule and or condemnation, and may portray me in a false light. In other words, if you get drunk, naked, or just downright bitchy, come off looking terrible and then lose all your friends and your job, that's on you, babe. Even worse, anything embarrassing that you do on the show, whether you were clothed, partially clothed, or naked, or aware or unaware of being filmed, is owned by the franchise forever. And you'll probably act a little differently from how you would in your day-to-day life because you're going to be separated from your family, friends, and your regular environment in Los Angeles until production is finished. Those conditions may expose you to severe mental stress, and you cannot seek refuge anywhere cameras aren't allowed. But if you suffer emotional and mental distress as a result of your portrayal in the show, the competition, or the isolation, just remember, you signed off on that. During production, you might have to engage in strenuous physical activity on dates. Hiking, wading, swimming, diving, parasailing, water skiing, other water sports or activities, skydiving, snow skiing, ice skating, rollerblading, and other physical activities yet to be determined. You may have to be a passenger in a watercraft, land vehicle, helicopter, or small plane. Even though everyone on the show is advised to refrain from all forms of violence and intimidation, you might be in close physical proximity to contestants who could exhibit physical or verbal aggression. And if you go on the show, you have to be single. You can't be married. You can't be living with someone with whom you have physical intimacy. You can't even date someone exclusively for more than 2 months. Once production begins, if you have sex with someone, you need to be aware that you're risking contracting sexually transmitted diseases. In the year following the finale of your season, you must be available to take part in a reasonable number of interviews, photo shoots, and chats for publicity. You also have to agree to take part in any special episodes of the show, like After the Final Rose or other reunions, for 3 years. And if you make it to the end of the batch and decide to get married within the 2 years following the show, the producers own the exclusive rights to your wedding. If they exercise those rights, they're only going to pay you $10,000 per hour of televised programming about your union. As for the ring given to you by Neil Lane, you don't own it and therefore cannot sell it for 2 years. Given all these guidelines, the question remains, why would anyone agree to go on this damn show? Don't the risks very obviously outweigh the benefits? There are plenty of former contestants I spoke to who admitted outright that they simply didn't read the contract. They wanted to be on TV and figured, what the hell? How bad could things get? Others, like Rosalind Papa, scrutinized the document. I read over every word of that contract, she acknowledged. I spoke about it with my family. We talked about what the repercussions could be and how they may twist things or edit things. But the advice of my family was, just don't give them anything that you wouldn't want to be seen by millions of viewers. As long as you are yourself and you stay away from drama and you don't drink a lot and you don't call anybody names and you respect the other people, then they're not going to have anything bad to show or to say about you. It's not that I was unaware of the potential ramifications. I just thought that it wouldn't apply to me. When I'd ask people who have been on The Batch about why they wanted to go on the show, I'd usually get some sort of roundabout answer. It all started as a joke. My friend submitted me. It's a free vacation, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Rarely, it seemed, were past contestants honest about what drew them to be on a reality show, likely because that would mean admitting to being unhappy with the monotony of their off-screen lives. Think about it, reasoned Papa. The majority of the girls on that show either don't have a job or they have a job where they can leave for 6 weeks. You're looking at women who aren't really in a solid place in life and probably have issues with identity or love or self-esteem. She makes a good point. Why apply to go on a reality show if your life is going swimmingly? Even if you're a Real Housewife, a Kardashian, or Tori Spelling, there's something greater at stake. Building a brand, getting more followers on Instagram, paying the mortgage. Being told that you're beautiful and interesting enough to star on television by a reality show producer, that's a pretty powerful form of validation. In her 2012 memoir, Melissa Rycroft, yes, the one who was proposed to by Jason Mesnick on The Bachelor, only to be dumped months later on After the Final Rose, admitted outright that she wasn't in a positive mental space when she was cast. She'd just broken up with a boyfriend, and though she was emotionally distraught, she thought The Bachelor would give her a fresh start. Even though I was still a mess inside, there was something about pretending to be put together that started to make me feel like I was that powerful woman I wanted to be, and that made it all easier, Rycroft wrote in her book, My Reality. I wasn't actually going on the show to look for love. I was simply going to move on with my life and find a new, happy place inside of myself. I needed to rediscover me. For others, the show provides an opportunity to get out of dead-end jobs. Desiree Siegfried, who was Desiree Hartsock before she became The Bachelorette in 2013, was working as a consultant at a Beverly Hills bridal salon before she went on TV. That may sound like a glamorous gig, but Siegfried said she was actually living paycheck to paycheck, just hoping she'd one day be able to save enough to start her own wedding dress design company. She was so broke that all she did was work and work out. She felt like she was barely getting by in LA, but even her ticket out of her day job, a spot on Sean Lowe's season of The Bachelor, was worrisome. Quitting my job was a huge risk, she acknowledged. And then even paying rent and the bills while I was gone, I didn't have it. Siegfried took the gamble, but as she made it further along on Lowe's season, she was forced to open up about her money troubles to producers. About rent time, I said, I won't be able to continue unless you pay my rent, she said. But I was so modest. I should have said, could you pay for my bills too? I felt so bad. So when I got off, I know I was backed up with all my bills. And what about the rarer applicant who actually loves their job? Obviously, not every boss is cool with an employee taking an unspecified amount of time off work, especially if that employee's reputation takes a hit during their hiatus. Harming his image was a major concern for Michael Garofalo, who had a prestigious job as a federal prosecutor in Miami when he was cast on Siegfried's season of The Bachelorette. He knew there was no way he'd quit his job to go on the show and thought it was highly unlikely that the U.S. Department of Justice would grant him permission for a leave of absence. So I go up to meet with the U.S. attorney, and I was really surprised by how well he took it, recalled Garofalo. He was like, well, of course they would want you. You're a great guy, and you're a very good catch. Still, Garofalo's request had to go through the ethics committee, but ultimately he received a letter signed by then-Attorney General Eric Holder saying he could embark on non-legal, non-paid, outside activity for 8 weeks. There were a few people who were against it, Garofalo remembered. But to be honest with you, my sense is that the people who were against it were a little envious. I had a great position as a lawyer and was still able to go have some fun and travel and have this unique experience. Nick Viall, who, yes, actually did have a real job before becoming a lifetime reality TV star, didn't have to jump through as many hoops to get off work. But when he was nominated by a friend to participate on the 2014 season of The Bachelorette, he still wasn't sure it would be beneficial to his career. At the time, he was 33 and had just been promoted to account executive at the cloud computing company Salesforce. He didn't want to quit, but everyone in his life thought he should go on the show. "I kind of became frustrated with my friends," he acknowledged. "I really wanted honest advice, but I equated it to buying a boat. If you go to your friend and are like, 'I'm thinking of buying a boat,' they're going to say, 'You should totally buy a boat. That's an amazing fucking idea.' But boats are a really bad investment. They're a lot of fun, but a lot of work. So everyone just wanted to go on my boat, see me go on TV." Still, Salesforce was encouraging, promising he could return to the company after he vied for Andy Dorfman's heart. Of course, they had no way of knowing then that he'd end up going on three more nationally televised batch journeys. Viall did return to Salesforce for a brief moment, but he eventually moved to Los Angeles to pursue a modeling career and do more reality television. Yes, that's right. After his first stint on The Bachelorette with Dorfman, he returned to the show as a surprise mid-season guest in 2015, when Caitlin Bristow was Lady of the Hour. As it turned out, Viall had slid into Bristow's DMs during the off-season, and when she became The Bachelorette, he decided to go on the show to try to date her. He ended up as the runner-up, once again. So then he headed to Bachelor in Paradise, the summer franchise spinoff where contestants from various seasons fly to Mexico to drink tequila on the beach and hook up. His turn on Paradise was such a hit with viewers that ABC decided to make an unconventional choice, casting him as The Bachelor in 2016. As a result, he finally got engaged. His fiancée was a beautiful special education teacher from Canada, Vanessa Grimaldi. The couple spent their first months together in public on yet another highly visible stage. Immediately after The Bachelor went off the air, Viall joined the cast of Dancing with the Stars. Not long after that reality show stint, he and Grimaldi broke up. Keep in mind that when I interviewed Viall for this book in late 2015, he told me he thought his time finding love on TV was done. "I'm Nick from The Bachelorette, and I get that," he said at the time, "but I don't want to be recognized for that. I don't want it to be what I'm known for. I'd rather people be like, 'Why do you have so many followers?'" In that same breath, though, he acknowledged that he got a rush from being recognized. Sometimes, he said, he'd walk into bars and catch himself looking to see if anyone noticed him. "You're like, ugh, what am I doing? I try to tell myself this isn't gonna last. I'm aware of how forgettable we all are." He may be aware of that fact, but he seems to be doing his darndest to fight it. Why I'm a fan. Heidi and Spencer Pratt. Spencer: "We basically only watch reality TV. The Chrisleys, Love and Hip Hop, all the Real Housewives, the Kardashians, Total Divas, Wags, Dance Moms, and Bachelor is our only broadcast show because it's pretty much a cable show on ABC. Heidi falls in love with a love story, and I'm more about what they're all doing for the camera. I know what's up. They're on the show trying to get IG followers and hashtag SpawnCon ads. But the reality is, I went on a TV show just for fame, and now I'm married with a kid, so the game is crazy." Our reoccurring game we play is figuring out what line was re-said in a testimonial that a producer created. Did you really say that, or was that purely for story? There's alcohol involved, so you're pumped up, and the producers are saying, "That was so good, you're so funny, oh my gosh, people are gonna love you." And then there's editing. I've been on multiple phone calls on reality shows where I was talking to one person and they used the footage to make it look like I was talking to somebody else. They bait you in. It's totally a mind game. You're tired, the lights are bright. On Big Brother, you'd be in bed completely asleep at 3 a.m. and they'd call you to the diary room. You will say whatever gets you back into bed because they'll drag it out. Heidi: "With scripted, everything is so regimented and planned out and every character acts a certain way. But with reality TV, you get to see how people really are, which is way more entertaining. Maybe people approve of it less, but it's also more realistic and human." Spencer: "And like scripted is so much better? On Game of Thrones, people are getting their heads chopped off and being burned alive, and it's like, that's what 20 million people should watch? People being brutally murdered by dragons, that's chill? I would much rather Corinne getting blacked out for America and love than watching people get murdered for an hour straight. Every hit show isn't a hit show because it's so wholesome and you're learning how to be a better human. People just love hating on other people who get famous for doing nothing. Viewers know people are getting paid and having fun and going to parties. I used to live tweet during The Bachelor, and I loved it until it became an unsafe environment. All I did was like a fellow Bachelor fan's tweet, and she said she wanted to kill herself. It was Anna Kendrick. She wrote something like, "Spencer Pratch is favored in my tweet. Looks like I now need to go kill myself." Chapter 5. Drafting a Game Plan. At this point, you're probably wondering, is anyone here for the right reasons? Does anyone actually go on The Batch hoping to find their soulmate? If you do, Sean Lowe, for one, thinks you're cray. My personal opinion is that if you go on that show and you genuinely think that you're going there to fall in love, you're probably a little off, said Lowe, who actually did end up finding his wife, Catherine Giudice, as The Bachelor. I think normal people do it for the experience. There were a couple girls on my show that came on and from day one they were convinced that they were in love with me, and I'm thinking, no, you're not. You're just a little batty. You're not in love with me. You don't even know me yet. About a month after Emily Maynard sent Lowe packing on The Bachelorette in 2012, producers reached out to him to see if he was interested in becoming the next Bachelor. After discussing the idea with his family, Lowe flew from his hometown in Texas to L.A. to meet with executive producer Martin Hilton and top brass from Warner Brothers Horizon and ABC. Martin was just really protective of the franchise, Lowe remembered. He was like drilling it in my head. We want you to stay humble. I have no aspirations of moving to Hollywood. I would like to think that I'm a pretty humble guy. That wasn't a big concern on my end, but that's what Martin wanted to make sure of. I guess they had painted me as this all-American guy on The Bachelorette, and they wanted to make sure that I stayed that way for The Bachelor. As soon as the higher-up signed off on Lowe, he understood Hilton's concerns. Once he was named The Bachelor, he was given a handler who catered to his every need, constantly running to get him food or drink. Producers started asking him where he wanted to travel on the show and what kind of women he was attracted to. "I don't discriminate. I said they could be whatever race. I don't really have a type, as long as they're nice and sweet." Meanwhile, ABC began to market him as America's heartthrob, building him up as a pure-hearted, religious guy who just wanted to settle down and raise a family. "They really treat you differently, honestly," he said of the transition from contestant to star. "Like, wait a minute, there's literally almost 100 people working on this show, you're the lead, and so many people are there to serve you. I can see why that would be one of Martin's concerns, because I think it would be very easy to get a big head." Every potential star, of course, presents different issues. The producers sent Canadian Bachelorette Gillian Harris to speech therapy in a bid to help her shed her accent, but canceled the classes after a few sessions revealed how integral her quirky voice was to her personality. Before Desiree Siegfried was named Bachelorette, meanwhile, producers wanted to make sure she'd present as emotional enough. She'd barely cried on Lowe's season and prided herself on her toughness. "They wanted me to be upset when I was talking about how I didn't grow up with money or cry when I was talking to Sean," she said. "I'm like, well, I'm not going to because I'm not sad about it." If she wanted the lead gig, producers said, she was going to have to show a diversity of feeling. Siegfried said she assured the team she is in fact a sensitive person and would do her best to not smile through everything. There are also financial considerations. The star of the show is the only one who gets paid, and the salary is negotiated based on what he or she might make it work during the production time period. "It's not a lot of money," said Ben Flanick, the winemaker who was The Bachelor in 2012. "They don't want it to be like you're going on this for the money. It's enough to cover your expenses while you're gone. I just think it depends on where you come from and what your burn rate is." Jen Schaft, who in 2005 served as the third Bachelorette, regrets how she handled the money talks. She said she didn't have any lawyers look at her contract because she felt like she was at the mercy of ABC and didn't want to give them any reason to not want to pick me. "I shouldn't have been such a stupid girl and just wimped out and not stood up for myself," she said, noting she was paid under $100,000. Meredith Phillips, the second Bachelorette, said she only made $10,000, which she was told was the show's flat rate. That figure is exceptionally low when compared to what her successors have made. These days, it would be incredibly rare for someone to make less than six figures as the star of the show. At least bachelors and bachelorettes are given free clothing, something contestants don't get unless they make it to the final rose ceremony. Instead, participants are sent an extremely vague packing list before the show kicks off. Both genders are told to bring clothes for all climates, swimsuits, winter jackets, sweaters, t-shirts, tank tops, casual day clothes, gloves, and warm hats, plus 14 formal outfits in case they make it through all of the rose ceremonies. The clothing needs to look good on camera, so no stripes, baseball caps or sunglasses, small checkered patterns, visible branding, or solid black or white. Oh, and everything needs to fit in two bags. If you're the bachelor or bachelorette, however, ABC hires a personal trainer for you and has you meet with stylist Carrie Fettman, who organizes fittings and puts together an entire wardrobe of clothing, gratis. During Emily Maynard's season of The Bachelorette, Fettman told In Touch magazine that he was given a budget of $350,000 to dress the Southern Belle, and he managed to exceed that figure. You get to keep everything because it's all tailored to fit you, which is amazing. But you also get in the best shape of your life to be on national television, so nothing really fit for too much longer after I came home, admitted Schecht. Those without professional help prepare for the show differently. Catherine Giudice only learned how to curl her hair the day before she left for the mansion. But Olivia Caridi, a broadcast journalist who knew how important it was to look good on TV, hired a professional makeup artist prior to meeting Bachelor Ben Higgins so that she could learn how to contour her face. The makeup artist had worked with people on reality TV and figured Caridi wouldn't be getting much sleep. So she advised on buying a white or nude eyeliner to put on my eyes to make them look bigger, which I didn't even know was a thing, the contestant told Allure. Ashley Iaconetti, who competed on Chris Soules' season, said she shelled out big time before heading to LA. She visited a boutique near her apartment in New Jersey and bought four gowns with the aid of her parents. I wanted super princessy stuff that I knew I'd never be able to wear again in any other atmosphere, she said. I was like, let's ham it up right now and play dress up. The store was willing to discount each dress by roughly $150, but looking back, Iaconetti wishes she'd gotten more of a bargain. So many of the girls on the show now get all their dresses for free, said Iaconetti, who had Botox and lash extensions when she was cast. They're like, hey, I'm going to be on The Bachelor. Can I borrow this dress? I'll tag you in a tweet when I'm wearing it in an episode. Instagram sponsorships weren't even possible back when Erica Rose traveled to Italy to meet European prince Lorenzo Borghese in 2006. Instead, the then-law student spent most of her time at the gym to prepare for the show. They did encourage everyone to get into their best shape, said the contestant famous for constantly donning a princess tiara. They'd say, maybe you want to lose some weight, maybe work out, whatever. I lost a lot of weight preparing for it. Everyone did. They just encourage it. Not to everyone, like if people were already really skinny, but to most of the girls. I was happy I did it because the camera probably does add 10 pounds. In addition to dieting, Rose got hair extensions and went tanning. The normal stuff, she said with a laugh. She also attempted to learn a few phrases in Italian, though she was disappointed to learn when she arrived on The Bachelor that Borghese didn't even speak the language fluently. Of course, guys stress about getting in shape too. Chris Bukowski, who went on a record five different Bachelor shows, first turned up on the franchise during Emily Maynard's season. He was cast only 3 weeks before production began, so he started going to the gym constantly and eating chicken nonstop, even keeping white meat in his pockets so he could have protein at the ready. It was the worst thing ever. I'm not a meathead, and I was slowly turning into one, he recalled. I would work out before work. I would work out when I got home from work. I'd run like 6 miles before I went to bed. It was ridiculous. Even Lowe, who worked as a fitness model at one point, cut out pizza and upped his sit-up routine, which worked out well for him since he went on to become the most off-shirtless bachelor ever. I was hoping I wouldn't come across as this really vain, egotistical guy who just has to be seen with his shirt off because it really wasn't my call, Lowe insisted. It felt silly, but I'm a gamer. It kind of goes back to being friends with the producers. They're like, come on, we really would like you to take your shirt off. And it's like, all right, I like you, so I'm going to go along with it, even when sometimes you didn't really want to. Whatever, I guess I'll just paint myself as the shirtless bachelor. Long before the limos roll up to the mansion, producers have already mapped out the roles they're hoping the cast members will fulfill. "We studied them ad nauseum before they arrived," said former producer Michael Carroll, explaining that a large board with headshots of all the women resided permanently in the office. "You pre-categorize everyone and have some shorthand as to who they were. Mom, Southern Belle, the cheerleader, the bitch. We all call them by ridiculous names. The fat one, the hot one, the crier, and sometimes the black chick." Since its inception, the Bachelor franchise has been overwhelmingly white. It took 15 years for the producers to cast an African-American as the lead, with lawyer Rachel Lindsay starring as the Bachelorette in 2017. Prior to that, however, the show's diversity track record was embarrassing. Of the 25 individuals cast each season, there were usually only a couple of people of color in the group. But between 2009 and 2012, when Jason Mesnick, Jake Pavelka, Brad Womack, and Ben Flanick were bachelors, there were no black women on the show. And no black men appeared on The Bachelorette between 2009 and 2011, when Jillian Harris, Ali Fedotowsky, and Ashley Hebert were its stars. "We always had to cast a black girl or two. ABC would say that," shared Scott Jeffress, who, to be fair, stopped working on The Bachelor in 2005. "It was very obvious to me that it was token. They're afraid of losing the audience. It's absurd. It was very upsetting to me. It would make the show more interesting. When some guy from the South is racist as shit and he becomes bros with some black dude and says stupid shit, that's talking about race, which we need to do today." Though critics had long made note of the show's diversity problem, it wasn't until a class-action racial discrimination lawsuit was brought against The Bachelor in 2012 that the issue started to gain any real traction. In the suit, Nathaniel Claybrooks and Christopher Johnson, two football players who had applied to be on the show, noted that over 10 years of the franchise, no person of color had ever been The Bachelor or Bachelorette. By only hiring white applicants, defendants are making the calculation that minorities in lead roles and interracial dating is unappealing to the show's audiences, the lawsuit argued. The refusal to hire minority applicants is a conscious attempt to minimize the risk of alienating their majority white viewership and the advertisers targeting that viewership. Nevertheless, such discrimination is impermissible under federal and state law. The lawsuit was eventually dismissed in 2012, with U.S. District Judge Aleda Trauger ruling the show's producers had a right to control their creative content and were protected by the First Amendment. Though she said Claybrooks and Johnson had a laudable goal, she explained that freedom of speech also gave The Cosby Show the right to cast mostly African Americans and Jersey Shore to star Italian Americans. Contrary to the plaintiff's argument, Mike Fleiss has long said, at least prior to Lindsay's season, that people of color simply don't apply to be on The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. "We really tried, but sometimes we feel guilty of tokenism," he told Entertainment Weekly in 2011. "Oh, we have to wedge African-American chicks in there. We always want to cast for ethnic diversity. It's just that for whatever reason, they don't come forward. I wish they would." Yet while Bachelor-esque dating shows on cable networks were filled with people of color, think MTV's A Shot at Love with Tila Tequila or VH1's Flavor of Love, ABC stuck with its time-worn formula. "I think it was like, if it's not broken, don't fix it," said Dwan Perrin, who was one of the first black producers to work on The Bachelor. "Like, VH1 can do that, or MTV can do that. They've done it, so we don't need to. We'll keep with tradition." The few women of color who did make it on The Bachelor had to fit a certain type. "Pretty, whitewashed, long hair, or fake hair," said Evan Majors, Levinson's old assistant, who is also black. Even then, the girl's chances wouldn't be good. "You just knew that girl wasn't going very far because it never happened, so it became a joke," said Carol. "We'd actually root for them. Like, come on. Episode 2? Man." When Lindsay was named as The Bachelorette in 2017, race was discussed more openly on the show than it ever had been before. Roughly half of the 31 contestants who were cast on her season were men of color, far more than had ever appeared on any season of The Bachelorette. But it was hardly smooth sailing for ABC. Right off the bat, Lindsay's season was down roughly 1 million viewers compared to the previous incarnation of The Bachelorette starring JoJo Fletcher. According to BuzzFeed, Nielsen ratings said Fletcher's audience was 86% white and 7% black. Lindsay's was 80% white and 12% black. And when racial issues arose, the show didn't do an excellent job of addressing them. Mid-season, Twitter users uncovered that one of the white contestants, Lee Garrett, had published a number of racist and misogynistic tweets in 2016, just a few months before he was cast. While ABC publicly denied any knowledge of said tweets, many in Bachelor Nation theorized that production purposely planted a racist in the cast to stir up drama. And stir up drama, Garrett did. The singer-songwriter, who hails from Nashville, immediately began to clash with a few of the black men on the show. His main nemesis was the wrestler Kenny King, whom he repeatedly called aggressive, playing into a triggering African-American stereotype. Garrett appeared to bait King into fights, often within earshot of Lindsay, and their contentious relationship ended up playing out as one of the main storylines of the season. And even after both men had been sent home, race still featured prominently on the show. Only one of Lindsay's final four suitors was black, leading some African-American viewers to criticize her for not supporting black love. Eric Bigger, the final black contestant on the season, he was sent home third to last, said he often received words of support from fellow African-Americans for making it as far as he did. "Even last night, I went out and it was like, thanks for holding it down for us," he said, just a week after the finale aired in July. "I'm not holding it down for you, I'm holding it down for me." Bigger, who works as a personal trainer in LA, full disclosure, my friend and I did work out with him one day and I almost died, said he'd never seen the show before he went on. He'd applied to be a cast member before he knew Lindsay was the star, and said prior to dating her, he dated exclusively white women for 6 years. "When it comes to love, the only pressure you should feel is the pressure you put on yourself," he said. "I'm not going off of what the culture thinks I should do. If I'm supposed to date Amy, I'm dating Amy. If it's Amy and Rachel, but I have the biggest connection with Amy, I'm dating Amy. It's not about the color. It's not fair. It's not even right. It's like selfish." "Think about where we live at," he continued. "There aren't that many African Americans in Los Angeles, at least not the area I'm in. It's not like Baltimore, where I'm from, where I see that every day." Bigger said he was more worried about discussing class than race with Lindsay, who was open about the fact that she came from a privileged background, attending private school in Dallas, Texas, where her father is a federal judge. Bigger, meanwhile, grew up in inner city Maryland and couldn't recall seeing his parents in the same room before his hometown date with Lindsay. A number of his relatives spent time in jail, he said, and he was constantly surrounded by crime. "At one point, I felt like if I really told Rachel where I was from, she wouldn't like me," he admitted to me. "I don't know why, but I was just a little insecure about that. But I said, you know what? I'm just gonna own it. I told her I'd come from a challenging environment in a tough city. She comes from a wholesome, grounded, structured family, and I don't come from that. So my thought was that it might make her uncomfortable. But that was a lie that was in my head. It wasn't true. And after I let it out, I felt better." Ultimately, Lindsay accepted a proposal from chiropractor Brian Abasolo, leaving runner-up Peter Krause to become the fan favorite for The Bachelor. Even though Bigger was beloved by fans, a few weeks after the show, he said the producers hadn't even approached him about being The Bachelor. In September, it was announced that white race car driver Ari Leyendijk Jr., who appeared on Maynard's season of The Bachelorette all the way back in 2012, was ABC's unlikely pick. It all makes me wonder how the producers saw someone like Bigger during the casting process. Was he labeled right off the bat? Broken family, from the hood, overcame adversity. I'd like to believe that isn't how the show views people, in these stereotypical boxes, but I've seen too much. During early seasons, at least, notes on each contestant would be circulated among top producers and kept in binders. There was standard biographical information included on all the contenders: name, age, hometown, job, salary, educational background. But certain notes would be highlighted. Indicators of personality traits or past traumas for the team to dig into during ITM interviews. I got my hands on one of the binders filled with annotated bios from Jesse Palmer's season. He was the fifth Bachelor, an NFL quarterback who has since gone on to become a Good Morning America contributor. By the time Palmer was a star of the show in 2004, the producers had this thing down to a science. Just listen to some of the notes the producers made about the potential ladies competing for his heart. The remarks, which are verbatim, by the way, though I didn't include every note on every young woman, don't paint the kindest picture of the producers. Instead, they come across as calculating and formulaic, and certainly not sympathetic. I've changed the names of the contestants to protect their identity since they're pretty much being mocked. Jamie, 21. Seems very young and immature, UCSB sorority chickish. Wants to find love on TV and have a $4 million wedding. Get her in the house because she'll drive the other girls crazy, or the other girls will definitely annoy her. Very producible. Another one who comes with strings. Could be a star on The OC and Dawson's Creek.